Anyway, I give you one more chance if you're so inclined. If anyone has any questions or topics or comments, hit that push to park and ID yourself.
AF2P, Ed, with a question.
Sure, Ed.
I'm wondering why there is not available, or maybe there is and I don't know it, an antenna launching system, like, you know, a gun that would fire a tennis ball with some kind of compressed gas to pull a line up into a tree. Why has nobody made such an animal that you could buy?
My guess would be that it would be a major liability issue. If that thing hits a person, if it hits the side of a building, if it hits a window, if it hits anything, among the many people that will be sued are the manufacturers. Because I have seen those things mentioned, but as either kits or instructions, they try to separate it from an actual physical object as much as they can because a lawyer told them to. So that would be my guess.
Okay, that stands to reason, because I have seen articles and kits, but nobody makes one, and I'm in need of one. I'll have to hire the tree man instead. Thank you.
Can you
hear me,
Steve?
Yes, Jim.
I've been exploring this topic a bit, and I've discovered that a lot of the laws that regulate things that make bigger bangs than what we're talking about, putting an antenna in a tree, put a crimp on our world. I'm pretty sure the answer lies somewhere with a tennis ball, a bungee cord, and a stick. I think it's a doable thing, but reasonable distances. I think most often, you know, people, when they want to talk on ham radio, or they want to put up an antenna, want to go to the highest tree in the land. Well, if you can get it to the medium tree regularly, it'll work. But I think that's the problem. Everybody chases the fars. I want to get to the top of the topest, the biggest tree. Maybe you can or you won't. You can't do it reliably. But with a modest thing, with a tennis ball, a bungee cord, and a stick, I think this is way more doable than most people give it credit for. I have a I can't prove to you that it's true, but I'm pretty sure it is true. Hold it, Roy.
Yeah, that would work. You could also just use a generic slingshot. I think they still sell slingshots. I think the lawyers haven't banned those yet. We give them a little bit more time. But that's the nature. We live in a litigious society. All kinds of things you sort of took for granted are now, you know, I mean, what was it? They called them darts, lawn darts. You know, lawns, you know, I mean, okay, every once in a while something terrible happened, but, you know, well, that's life. But now you can't buy a lawn dart. For a time, they told people that you wouldn't be able to buy strong magnets because little children had this tendency of swallowing them and producing severe medical emergencies. So, you know, there's ways to get away with it if you don't want a really powerful device. So your advice is good. Alex, the 82DU in the chat room, mentioned the slingshot. That would work as well to a degree. But, you know, unfortunately, society has decided that they have to be our nannies and protect ourselves from ourselves. So, you know, that's the nature of our time we live in. It was much easier to get yourself killed back in the old days because, you know, people just did what they felt like doing.
Okay, a related question, if I may.
Sure.
Why hasn't anybody built or figured out how to use a drone to haul a fishing line up to the tree and then, you know, pull the bigger rope? Or has that been done?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, as far as I know, the slingshots
illegal in New York State for, well, for decades. If I remember, I wanted to do that back in the 80s. And I don't think they ever reversed that law. And as far as the drones go, I worked a guy in California that used a drone to get his line up on a tree, you know, with a release mechanism. You know, I guess he hit a button to do that. Hams have done it all, but I think the slingshots are probably still illegal in New York State. Back to you.
No, okay. Is it possible to buy them in New Jersey and just kind of drive them back home?
I guess. Can you order one through Amazon? Then what happens if you knock somebody's eye out? The liability factor creeps in again. Roy, back to you.
Yeah, there's always the liability issue. I mean, you could throw a rock, and if it hits someone, they'll sue you. Even if you miss, they'll probably sue you, just for the emotional pain and suffering.
You know, I've always done. I have this bag filled with sand, and I put a clip on it. Spin that around and let it go at just the right time, you know. And, you know, it goes over the branch, and believe it or not, you get, well, anyway, I got very good at it after a while. You know, I mean, I'm not going to the top of the tree, but I'm getting up there pretty high.
Okay, but it's a skill you have to develop. It's not an automated system where you just push a button and the mechanics takes care of the rest. But, yeah. That usually is the last thing that lawyers decimate, but, you know, give them time.
KMQZZ.
Okay, and what I use is, well, I used to cut branches that were in the way of the dipole. And years ago from Sears, I guess you could forget it, you know, you get this rope, and it's got, you know, lengths, you know, maybe 30 feet on one side, 30 feet on the other side, and then you have this chainsaw blade in between in the middle. And then what you would do is it would come with this weight, this sandbag weight, and that's how you got this rope over the branch. And then eventually, you know, you pull one end and until the blade gets to where you want it to go, and then you work, you know, then you work both ropes back and forth until the branch breaks. You know, I used to do that, but that sandbag, of course, is good forever. I've been using that forever for putting the dipoles up. That's the one I hook to a string, spin it around, and open a branch. Back to you, Ross.
Okay, well, I mean, that's the beauty of sand. It doesn't corrode. It doesn't evaporate. It just sits there. Brian, you wanted to say something?
Oh, happy July 4th, everyone. I know I'm late, but I am here standing by. If anybody has any questions, you know, whoever goes first.
Well, we only have about 3-4 minutes for this segment, and we've gone through everyone else, so if you got a question, feel free to ask it.
I wanted to just say hello. I went into a morgue this weekend, and in the morgue, there was a magician with a wand, and he opened the door, he pulled out a body, of course the body had a sheet over it, and he pulled off the sheet, and he waved his wand, and he goes, abracadabra.
I actually heard that one before, but you have to understand that, you know, doctors get a lot of dead people jokes.
Okay, well, on a serious note, I just wanted to go ahead and understand one thing. I was on HF today on a frequency of 7195.00, And it was, of course, LSB. And then I had my amplifier on, so I was running about maybe, I would say, 550 or so going out. And mysteriously, and I even have it on video, my FTM 500 from Yaesu, the mobile rig I'm speaking on right now, it lit up. Not the display, but all the buttons when I was transmitting. Question is, how and why?
Well, the immediate answer would be, I don't know, but most likely some strange little RF hiccup that got to the processor chip. Fortunately, it was not a permanent problem. So I can't exactly tell you what little signal leak kind of made the processor do that. But, you know, it's probably going to be a one-shot thing, though, so it'll probably not be reproducible.
WS2N. Oh, it's
yeah,
absolutely
cool.
Reproducible. I did it on 7195 three times. What I don't understand is I can't put a Faraday cage in my ham shack. So any suggestions? I'm open to anything at this point. Not that I probably will go on 7195 in the very near future. It was just kind of surprised me.
Yeah, Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yes, that'll happen. And I have an HC, and you know, have the charger, and I have the charger on the desk, and with my older rig, the Kenwood 440, when I would transmit, since CW in particular, the little LED light on the charger, you know, it would follow my code, you know. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You see the little light blinking on and off. So RF was getting into that somehow. So to avoid that problem, I just moved that about 8 feet away from me. And that went away. And when I got a new rig, in this case the 7300, that does not happen. So, you know, that little RF getting out from somewhere, and in your case, the 500 watts is definitely getting out somewhere. Back to you, Ron.
Okay, very good. Well, I don't know if you really want to, you know, have a real Faraday cage around your equipment or get some tinfoil. Probably not worth the effort, I would think, but If you could find a sweet spot in your shack where that doesn't happen or happens to a much lower extent, that's probably the best you're going to be able to get.
I tend to agree. There's really not much that I can go ahead and do. It happens on just that one frequency. If it happens on others, I'll have to go ahead and bring it to the attention of Yaesu for all it might matter. I don't think it's going to mean anything, but I just figured I'd go mention it while we have another minute left. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it could be a not meant resonance of parts of the pattern that make up the PC board of the radio. And it just, you know, it had to kind of be resonant at some frequency, so it's resonant at that frequency, and it triggers a lot of little reversible, thankfully, glitches.
Are these radios that are made today, or say within the past, let's say, 20 years, are they really more poorly shielded than radios from years ago?
Say again?
Radios that are made today, or let's say for the past 15, 20 years, are they less shielded than radios made way before that?
I think ultimately it depends on the manufacturer and the model class. You know, I'm sure Baofengs are the least shielded radios known to mankind. A lot of the older ones were much better shielded accidentally in that they tended to build the chassis out of steel thick gauge metals, and they weighed a ton, but they shielded a lot of outside RF. So it depends upon what you're talking about. Nowadays, the external covering of a lot of radios are mostly plastic, which doesn't stop any RF. So it depends upon the manufacturer, how much they're willing to spend, and how much they're willing to think about the internal shielding of their radios versus the old anchors that were just built that way, because that's the way those radios were built.
I think also maybe the FCC lowered their standards for emissions.
I don't know. I mean, you could probably look up the regulations to see if they did that. I haven't heard about any particular alteration in those regulations, but not like they send me a notice.
Since we live in a era where everything is electronic, microprocessors, digital, so on and so forth, versus old analog systems, it's not surprising to me that they would be more susceptible.
Yeah, it's possible. Also, a lot of our equipment inside runs at a much higher frequency than the old electronic equipment did. Just because it was kind of difficult to amplify high frequencies, signals and such. So there's a lot of things going on that's changed, especially the nature of the way that electronics are built today, as opposed to 60 years ago, where it was much spread out.
I thank you very much for your analysis. Standing by.
You're welcome, as always. Good to have you aboard. Well, it's already almost 10:20, so it's a perfectly good time to turn the technical net over to Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
Oh, okay, very good. And good net. I did have a hard time copying West tonight. I don't know if it was over-modulating or, it was hard to figure out a lot of the words he was saying. So West, if you're listening, I might want to check that out during the week. Maybe you could make a different adjustment. Roy, you must have good ears. I had a tough time.
Yeah, unfortunately, there wasn't enough treble, and I think he was kind of overdriving the mic a bit. I saw some kind of flattening of the waveform a bunch of times, so the two things kind of went hand in hand, unfortunately.
Okay, yeah, it wasn't too bad, but, it could be better. In the past weeks, he's been a lot better. Anyway, the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. The first thing I wanted to talk about is back in the early 1990s. It was 1990 when NASA launched the Hubble Space Telescope, and they couldn't get that thing into orbit fast enough. Meanwhile, it took a couple more years to send up a service crew to make some adjustments to perfect that telescope. But even back then, all the scientists were thinking, what could we do next? And they had the idea of something called the Next Generation Space Telescope. And that's what they were going to call it at the time. Eventually it got a name, James Webb Space Telescope, which is sitting out there right now, very successful piece of equipment. But when it was called the Next Generation Space Telescope, they were making predictions that maybe with that we might be able to, for the first time, be able to actually photograph or take a picture of a planet, in a different solar system.
And to date, that really hasn't happened until now.
The James Webb Space Telescope just recently did capture a picture in infrared, but it's still an actual picture of a planet. It's got a mass of about 100 times the size of Earth, but it's orbiting a star, and the star is 34 miles away. They gave it a name, TWA-7. And they believe it's also within the Goldilocks range, where you might be able to actually have water existing on that planet, because the temperatures are, within the criteria. You need temperatures roughly between 5 degrees and they say 100, they say 200 degrees. You're between that, and this is around 120 on that planet. It might even have water there, so. I mean, it's going to be maybe 1,000 years before we can get to a planet like this, but it's a start, and it's strange back then listening to reading through magazines predicting that someday they'll be able to actually photograph a planet. And at that time, they didn't even know 100% if there were any planets going around stars. But of course, now we know there's not only thousands, but there's probably billions of them. Question. It's a change from gravitational lensing. They've tried that. They use the light. Like the Kepler telescope, they use the light of the planet. It would just dim slightly at a certain point, so they would know a planet was going around that star. They would know how often it goes around the star and all of that. That's been working great. They've proven out thousands of planets, but this is the first time that I've read that they actually have confirmation using the infrared picture of, through the James Webb Space Telescope. Any comments? WS2I.
I'm curious. This is Brian, KF2CC. I'm curious to know a couple of things. A, what does the picture actually look like in infrared? Is it just a couple of pixels? And two, if it's more than a couple of pixels, could that be translated into visible light using an algorithm?
Well, I haven't seen the picture yet. And I'm sure that will come out. In fact, I just read this the other day. I'm sure they have probably, maybe on the Jet Propulsion Laboratory website. I'll have to look for that. And yeah, infrared is, with our eyes, see it, but, using that, that's what they do with infrared all the time anyway. Even if you have infrared goggles, you're looking at something, in reality, it's dark, you're not seeing that thing, but yet you're seeing it. It works like a transducer, you're coming in at really one frequency in the infrared frequency, and it's converting it to the visible spectrum. So basically, they do that all the time anyway. If you get a picture, an X-ray, they do that, or you do it in an ultraviolet, or in this case, infrared. Back to you, Brian.
I think today's pixel would be tomorrow's, it will be much, much more. I think they just have to, the technology will march on and on and on. But I want to know, how far is the planet away from Earth?
Yeah, the article said it was 33. I think it was 33 light years from Earth. So it's a long ways away, but it's, you know, in our neighborhood. You know, I mean, if you think about it, Alpha Centauri is what, roughly four light years away. Then some of the other ones, Wolf 359, I think that's, you know, half a dozen light years away, and so on and so forth. Bernard star. And then you go further out, and this one is in our local group, I guess. Back to you.
Has the JWST ever targeted Alpha Centauri to see if there are any planets around it, and even tried to image them if there were?
I don't know. I'm sure we could find out real quick. Don't know if they've looked at Alpha Centauri. You know, you have a Proxima. You got at least three planets, I believe, in that system. And when I was younger, they always said it was Alpha Centauri, always the closest. But as time went on, they realized, for some reason, Proxima is the closest one, and the other planet going around. But, you know, it's not much of a difference. They do know that I think it's two or three planets going around Alpha Centauri. And I believe Alpha Centauri is also a double star system. It's a binary system. Back to you, Brian.
Well, I would think that if there's a star, there must be a planet. I don't know if there are any exceptions to that rule. Otherwise, logically speaking, would be just an awful waste of energy.
Yeah, they know there's... I'm sure it was at least two planets, I believe. Anyway, that was all done with, you know, using the light method. You know, I'm not sure which telescope did that. We have another one called TESS, the TESS telescope. That is a similar way of doing it. It's really got a bunch of light photocells inside looking at the sky. And they look at all the local stars with, I think that one looks after around 200 light years out, where the Kepler telescope, the first few years, 3 years, it stared at one spot in the sky and looked at a couple of thousand planets, stars, and they were looking with that. And then the liquid hydrogen, or liquid helium ran out. They used it as a cooling device to keep keep that Kepler going. And then a certain things failed. The gyros failed, and a couple of gyros are still working. They figured out a way to keep it going, and they, instead of staring at one spot, they just pointed it, you know, away from the sun, looking out, and as it went around, you know, every year would go around the sun, but always looking out away from the sun, and it did a scan that way, and then, you know, many, many more stars, you know, found countless planets. So that was one of the most successful telescopes, that one, and TESS, the main ones, and then there's another one by European Space Agency. But I think that's a little different. Anyway, back to you, Brian.
I was just thinking about, you know, possibilities, especially with so many advances in imaging. whether the JWST is, well, you know, is that considered to be state of the art now, or was it state of the art then when it was conceived?
Yeah, that holds true for everything, right? I mean, they just opened the Vera Rubin telescope down in Chile, 27-foot mirror, and it's going to scan the whole sky, the southern sky, every 10 days, which is, you know, remarkable. It would have taken like a year with any other telescope. Now they can do it like every 10 days. They're going to put it together and eventually have a video. And that thing just came online. But when that was under development, they thought about that one, I think I read 20 years ago, when they started planning for that, and eventually getting the funding for it and all. So, yeah, that was about probably 20 years ago. And today, I guess, as a working telescope, it is the state of the art for today. But, you know, they have things on the drawing board today that's going to be, you know, built either on Earth or in space 10, 20 years from now. And that'll be the new, you know, cat's meow. Back to you.
So it's really a question of government and funding more than anything else, right?
You know, money makes the world go around, but, you know, yeah, you need scientists, engineers, and then technicians. You know, scientists to figure what they're looking for. And then you need, you know, engineers to develop these things, how it's going to be put together. And then technicians to actually put these things together. And somehow you all have to agree. And then somebody has to tell somebody, we need a bunch of money. So if all those things work out, you know, you can get a new telescope.
Well, that's interesting. I find the SETI project, I don't know if it's still operating. I thought they were going to upgrade it so it could go ahead simultaneously transmit and receive on millions and millions of frequencies and scan them, like, with the speed of a supercomputer and look for patterns and such. Has that ever really proved out?
Are you talking about the Allen Array? That's still up and running. Paul Allen, he was partnered with Gates, you know, early on, and he took a bunch of his money and invested into, I don't know, countless antennas. They're located in California, and they're looking at the sky, and they're always looking for the SETI contact. I know that one's still going. And other ones have been used temporarily. They even used Arecibo for a while, but of course that thing that was lost during Hurricane Maria. But then they have the, I forget how many kilometer antenna system in Africa. And that thing's like an interferometer system with other antennas. And that's always looking at the sky. But that's not necessarily looking for aliens. But the Paul Allen one was and probably still is. Back to you, Brian.
It would be nice to go ahead and know if they have a state-of-the-art system in operation that could go ahead and transmit literally millions of frequencies with patterns every, I don't know, hour, minute, whatever it might be, and then be able to go ahead and scan those frequencies on receive and see on a continual basis, and using AI, using algorithms, actually, to see if anything comes back. I wonder if we're kind of like you know, missing a lot, or you're shooting in like one big hole and leaving all the other holes, you know, blank. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know a lot of that is being done, even with the new Rubin telescope down in Chile that they just opened. That's the one with the biggest charge coupled device, biggest, it's like you're in diameter, and the light comes down and hits that thing, and the data that's coming out of that has to be transferred, I think, to some kind of supercomputer system. I thought it was in California, somewhere, and then there's another one as a backup, I think, in a different country. And all of that is going through, like you said, you know, all kinds of AI and things looking for things. And, you know, that's the future. I think that telescope's going to be involved with that. And, you know, I don't know much about AI, but I know it eliminates a lot of the, well, what we would call the noise, you know, which is good, you know. Get rid of the things that you don't need to look at, and, you know, maybe they'll find something moving across the screen that we wouldn't normally look at. Now, Vera, she was the one, they named that telescope after her, and she was the one years ago that used to stare at those plates, you know, actual photograph plates, and looking for any kind of change in the motion of the stars. So she would look at the galaxy, you know, say M31, you know, the Andromeda galaxy, look at something like that, and be looking at local stars, even our own star system, galaxy. And you look at the stars, and she would painstakingly stare at plate after plate, and eventually she noticed that the stars were moving around the center of the galaxy, but they weren't moving the way, you know, general physics said they should have been moving. And based on that information, they eventually said, well, something's making these things move at a speed than what we expect. So there must be some kind of energy there doing it, some kind of gravitational pull. And they decided to call that dark energy. So she's really credited with that type of thing. But look what you went through, you know, looking at plate after plate after plate. Now you have AI that could probably do it like, you know, a million a second or something. Back to you, Brian.
No, I heard of a new telescope and haven't really explored the page yet on the internet concerning it. What I find kind of odd, though, maybe I'm completely wrong, but if you take a good deal of the electromagnetic spectrum and you scan it, and of course this is easier said than done, probably need multiple antennas and, you know, different transceivers and stuff like that. I just can't believe we didn't pick up a single candidate signal yet. But actually, no, I can believe we didn't pick it up yet, because I don't know if we're looking right or not so much in the right place, but I just don't know if we're transmitting and receiving correctly to understand these patterns, unless there's something different than the electromagnetic spectrum that can be used for communications that we don't know of yet.
Yeah, well, for now we're stuck with RF. You know, I'm sure they'll be looking at the laser transmissions, and, you know, in the future. But temporarily, anyway, that's kind of limited. You know, we're able to transmit laser. So far, the record is almost out to the orbit of Mars successfully with a laser, you know, transmission. So that's okay. What was I going to say? I was going to say something about the new telescope. Well, I know what it was. There's a picture of what the charge coupled device looks like on the Vera Rubin
telescope. If you go to Roy's website, roy.ac2gs.com, and down a couple of pages, you'll see this woman scientist holding onto this big board, and that's the charge couple device they're going to be using, that they are now using for to copy all this stuff, which is amazing. You know, that you think of a little thing inside your cell phone camera, you know, taking pictures. This thing is like almost a meter in diameter. Not quite, but it's close to it. Back to you, Brian.
Right. So I think that the signals that we're sending are being sent, I think that they're sent digitally, but it's, you know, it's a question of on the receiving end, you know, if they actually could receive the signals and how far away they are and a million other variables. They may not even be listening on that frequency. Who knows? But I would be used it. I watched the movie called, it was an excellent movie a long time ago. I saw it like about three times, Contact. I think you've probably seen it too. And it was a really good comment that was made by the scientist, that lady. She said, well, you know, if the universe is all this vast and there's no life outside, it would be an awfully big waste of space. And I think we're just not using the correct technologies, or maybe they know things that we don't and that we don't understand what they're doing.
Yeah, I think that was a great movie, by the way. I think Einstein was the one that actually said that, so I think they were quoting him, but I'd have to double check on that. Yeah, Ellie, her name was, right? So that was terrific. And the star that they were looking at was Vega, and that was roughly 25 light years away. So they figured out that any transmissions from Earth that left the atmosphere just keeps on going. You know, it would take years and years for it to get there. So apparently, the signals were picked up around Vega, you know, from Earth, and they knew to start sending signals back to Earth, you know, and then it's a, in that case, what years for us to transmit there, and another 25 years to transmit back. So any transmissions that we made here looking for aliens, you know, we got a long way before they copy the signal, Ryan, that's for sure. Arecibo did it in, I think, 1992, because they needed to do something for, you know, the discovery of America. You know, 1492. So they needed something to do for the 500th anniversary. So they decided to transmit from Arecibo, and they did. And they sent digital information, and if you were to decode it, it would look like kind of like a person, more like a robotic person, like, you know, look like it would have a square head, a square body, and some weird look if you were to actually decode it. So that was sent out in 92, and that's still going. And they sent it out toward the center of the Bio galaxy. So they figured, well, you know, there's like countless stars, you know, hundreds of millions of stars at the center of our galaxy. You just signal from Aris when they get there. Unfortunately, that's going to take around, I think it's around 25,000 light years to get to the center of the galaxy. So we got a long wait, like I said before, Brian. Back to you.
Well, it's understood. You know, it's you could philosophize about this a million different ways. And it's interesting nevertheless. So the Vera Rubin telescope, what is it going to be able to see that the JWST can't see? Or is it just, is it all in, you know, how should I say, in the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum, or is it radio?
Yeah, they have pictures up now. You know, you put in Vera Rubin and pictures and put in the Vera Rubin telescope and new pictures. And the earliest pictures that they're working with are already back. And, it takes a while to actually commission it. They do a lot of tests, probably for the first, month or so. And this thing only came online about a week or so ago. So, but they already have pictures. But they predict there's going to be countless discoveries made with this thing.
Sometimes I wish I was born 200 years from now, and then something tells me that I wish I wasn't born 200 years from now, because there might not be anything to go ahead and look through.
Okay, very good. Yeah. Or 200 years ago. I don't know. The Victorian era looked pretty cool, but, it must have been a tough life. And that looks like a pretty good time frame. All the new inventions, telephones, telegraphs, things coming out. that was probably a good time. For that type of thing. You wouldn't want to catch a cold, though. I don't think they had the medicines to fix you up if you got sick from some reason, like bubonic plague or something. Anyway, I wanted to mention the Vulcan rocket is being stacked in Florida, Cape Canaveral, and Launch Complex 41. It's the same complex that they launched the Atlas V on a regular basis. They just launched the Atlas V, a couple weeks ago, and already they're ready for a new Vulcan rocket. The United Launch Alliance is using the same launch complex for both rockets. They only have a half a dozen or so more Atlas V's to go anyway. But they have the capability of doing both. The Vulcan rocket is replacing the Atlas V eventually. It's much more powerful and it's much more reliable. It's got these two big BE-4 engines built by Blue Origin. Blue Origin got a contract to make all the engines for Vulcan. So looking forward to a launch on a Vulcan not too long in the future. It is a liquid methane, liquid oxygen booster. And then the second stage is liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. Centaur upper stage. That is a pretty formidable, proven vehicle, rocket stage. It's been around for decades. They have the capability of running solid boosters attached to it. So far they've... although the last flight that they did, they've successfully launched two Vulcan rockets, but one of the solid boosters, they noticed some charring came off on the nozzle of one of the solid boosters. It didn't affect the flight, which is why the government really likes this vehicle, because, the payload got to its proper orbit, even with problem with the solid. So the SRB, the solid rocket booster, has been repaired, the design of it, and that will be put into operation. You'll be seeing these things go off eventually, every in the beginning, every couple of months, and then every month, and quite often as time goes on. Looking forward to Vulcan. Any comments?
What do they intend to go ahead and send up? Just an increasing number of satellites? Or what's the ultimate purpose?
This will launch government or private. No problem. The one they're getting ready for is a government launch. They've already launched one with no payload as the first inaugural launch. That was successful. And then the one after that did have a payload, and that was successful. Now this will be a government launch. And eventually, they will be launching on a regular basis for the next couple of years, quite a few years anyway. They'll be launching satellites for Jeff Bezos' Amazon company. They're putting up the broadband satellites. Atlas V has launched two missions for them so far, the first two main missions. And each one of those, they sent up 27 satellites each. Every one has been successful. They're in orbit now. Looks very good for the future of the Kuiper. They call it the Kuiper broadband system by Amazon. So future Kuiper missions, well, there's a couple more planned for Atlas V, but there's also new ones planned for the new rocket, the Vulcan rocket that we're talking about. And when that goes up, they'll be launching 45 satellites at a time. It's a bigger rocket. It's got more thrust. It could bring up more payload. So instead of the Atlas is doing, Vulcan will be bringing 45 up at a time. And this will go on month after month, year after year, until they eventually get around 3,200 of them up there. But it's not only, they're not only going to use the Vulcan and Atlas rockets to get the Kuiper broadband system up there, they're going to use other ones as well. They're also contracted with the Ariane 6 rocket, which is European Space Agency. They've got contracts to launch Kuiper satellites with them. They also have a contract with them, well, actually with themselves. Blue Origin is the builder of the New Glenn rocket. New Glenn successfully launched once, and they plan on launching another one soon. They will be taking up Kuiper satellites as well. And then they also contracted with SpaceX. You know, even so, SpaceX is a competitor, not only with rockets, but with broadband as well. SpaceX has the Starlink system. But enough money to launch a competitor for you. In fact, they've already done that. They launched OneWeb satellite. There's also a broadband constellation that's up there now. I think they have 500 satellites up there or something. They're in operation. Any comments? WS2N.
Just looking at some of those Vera Rubin photos, rather impressive, actually. Rather impressive, have to admit. But, with all of this, I kind of wonder, something comes into my mind, with all of these satellite launches and all the space junk that's around our planet, do these telescopes actually get a clear view, or do some of these, like, little objects have to be blocked out?
It's some reason they're not picked up fly the telescopes as you, I mean, they have the capability of doing it. They could zoom in or zoom out to pick up the all the satellites going around the Earth. But when you focus further out, for some reason, it's like having dust on your eyeglasses. You know, a couple of pieces of dust. You know, you don't really notice that. You're looking further away. But yet, if I take my glasses off and I look real close, I change the focal length of my eye to glass, I can see the dust on the lens. I think it's kind of like that. Anyway, it's getting late already. Yeah, I just want to mention the H-2A rocket. That's a Japanese rocket that launched last week as well on its final mission, final and 50th mission of all the years it's been going up. That's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, heavy medium to heavy lift vehicle. Different versions of the H-2A. They've had the H-2B and the H-3. The H-2B was a little stronger. It had more thrust, and they used that specifically and only for cargo vehicles to the International Space Station. You know, for 9 years, every year, it took, Japan would launch another cargo vehicle to the space station years ago. And it would bring up everything that the astronauts would need. And this would happen year after year. Once a year, they launched the, they call it the HTV vehicle to the International Space Station using the H-2B rocket. You know, the one that's now been retired is the original one, H-2A. But now, even the H-2B is going to be put aside. Well, for the H-3, the H-3 is going to launch everything that Japan wants to launch, so it's less expensive, it's complicated.
That time, system. Complete.
Again, it is a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen vehicle, but the H-3 will be also used for future cargo vehicles. Japan is building a new version of a cargo vehicle. They haven't done that in quite a few years to the space station, but this other one is under construction. It's going to be able to carry more stuff. It's going to be able. It's got different capabilities than the old HTV cargo vehicle. But that'll be launched on the new H-3, which has successfully launched three times. So it's proven to be a good vehicle, the H-3. So in the future, once we have the Gateway space station in orbit around the moon, you know, with crews on board and all that, they're going to need to be restocked with stuff. One of the groups that have a contract for doing that is Japan, with this new version, the HTV version of it. Of a cargo vehicle that will not only go to the International Space Station for restocking, but will actually go to the Gateway space station around the moon for restocking. In that case, and they will use the H-3 rocket to do that. So a lot happening. You know, it doesn't happen. You know, every day. The rocket launches almost every day now, but advancements do come by little by little. I'm glad to see it looks like the space launch system has not been canceled, and either as the Gateway, which I've been predicting anyway. There's too many billions of dollars involved with the space launch system and the Gateway space station. If you look at the predictions with the with this administration, they were going to stop it, but for some reason this has now been reversed as of now. You know, I mean, these people, you know, they change their minds
you know, like I change my clothes, you know, but hopefully they stick to it this